Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We never thought the world would let this happen. Those are the words of today's guest, Wad Al-Khatib, a 26-year-old Syrian filmmaker who documents her life over 5 years during the brutal Assad regime as she falls in love, gets married, and gives birth to her daughter, Sama. Her incredible footage has been turned into a film called For Sama. It's an intimate portrayal of families that chose to stay in Syria as the bombardment intensified. For Sama is an unflinching look at the lives that were destroyed. It's estimated that over 500,000 people have been killed since the revolution in Syria began in 2011. According to the UNHCR, at least 5.5 million people have fled Syria since 2011, and 6.5 million have been displaced internally. Nearly 3 million are still living in hard-to-reach and besieged areas. And before we get started with today's show, I just want to play the trailer because it is so powerful. Here is the trailer for the new documentary For Sama.
Hello.
Aleppo.
Medinti.
My city. I keep filming. It gives me reason to be here. This is insane. We're getting this every day. None of us had any idea. Hello, Dr. Hamza. Our old lives would be changed forever.
Hamza,
I'm pregnant.
Sama.
I've made this film for you. I need you to understand what we were fighting for. I love you so much, even more than the snow. There's lots of airstrikes today, right?
Sama,
I know you understand what's happening. I can see it in your eyes. You never cry like a normal baby would. That's what breaks my heart.
The hospital has been bombed.
My daughter's in there. Sama, will you ever forgive me?
And thanks to Democracy Now! For that trailer of For Sama. You can find information about when the film will be in your area. Wad Al-Khatib was a student in Aleppo, Syria, when she began documenting the uprisings as a citizen journalist. She started out by sending her footage to Channel 4 in the UK for a series called Inside Aleppo. And Wad Al-Khatib joins us in studio. Hi, Wad. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. We're also joined by Wad's husband, Hamza Al-Khatib, a doctor and co-founder and former director of the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo. Hi, Hamza. Thank you so much for joining
us.
And Edward Watts is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker who has directed over 20 narrative and documentary films, and he is director of For Sama. Hi, Edward. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I watched the film last night, and I woke up thinking about it, and I don't know how to word it, but it's shocking and amazing that you both survived.
Thank you.
I mean, it was shocking for us.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. We never thought that we will make it. We always, like since the beginning, maybe from 2012, we knew that at one day there will be a bomb, and like the only like good thing that we wished is like for this explosive or the bomb to take us together. And like not be like separated, And but it was worse that we were displaced out of our city and our country. Like, this is not never like the life that we would like dream about.
And the other fact that, you know, we've watching this today as a film, as a piece of art and like reality of what's going on. And at the same time, like today as we're speaking, the situation in Syria is still the same horror and the same bad situation. And all the people who were displaced from Aleppo with us and other people displaced from other cities, they are now having the same experience exactly as we like have 3 years ago, unfortunately.
Wad, what goes through your mind when you hear that trailer?
It's really very mixed feeling between, like, the first things, how much I'm proud of what we've went through, how much I'm proud with every single person who was in Aleppo City, our friends, the hospital, the other hospitals, everyone who was, like, the white helmet, everyone who was doing anything in the city. I'm so proud of that experience and that feeling that give us that human being. They are like more powerful than all these weapons. The other things is really like the disappointed from the world, from the others, whoever they were, how we've still having the same experience until now and no one can really make any difference in these people's life.
It really struck me in the film when you said, we never thought the world would let this happen.
Yeah, because, you know, we've thought that we are 2016 at that moment. And, like, just, you know, we are in the life of democracy and freedom and technology also. So, like, others know exactly what's going on the ground. And the presidents, the governments, the Western governments, which they were all the time speaking about the human rights of human being. And this is just was, we felt in a lot of moments that this is all fake.
Wow. Edward, how did you connect with Wad and Hamza?
Well, I only met Wad after they'd been forced to flee from Aleppo, because no one really had any idea that she built up this incredible archive of their lives over 5 years. It was only when she came to London and met with some of our colleagues from Channel 4 that she produced these 12 hard drives with this extraordinary collection, over 500 hours of footage, which captured not only the horror, you know, the real human tragedy of the conflict in Syria and Aleppo, but also all the humanity, all the beauty of their lives there, of their love story, of their baby Samer as well. And so I think they thought it was because it was such a huge undertaking to try and distill that into a form that was digestible. They thought she might be able to use a collaborator, and they approached me because they knew I cared so much about Syria. And I did just want to follow on from Wad's point. You know, one thing, as we always say, the world did nothing, but, you know, when ISIS appeared, the world did move very fast. That's always something that a point that you guys make. So it's not like people are incapable of action when they feel suitably motivated, but when it came to the, you know, civilian toll in Syria at the hands of the Assad regime, they made a different calculation.
How much did you know about what was happening in Syria before you connected with Wad?
Personally, I knew a lot about it because ever since the revolution started, I just felt that this was very different. You mentioned, you know, Iraq and places like that. Like, this was so different because...
And you've been in other places before, so...
Yeah. I'd made a film about... I've been in Afghanistan, I've been in Israel-Palestine, I've been in Yemen, I've been in Congo. I'd seen a lot of these different conflicts, but this just felt so different because here you essentially had a secular, educated, middle-class people who were just asking for their basic rights that we all take for granted, and they were being met with the full military force of a nation state. That was the decision the Assad regime made from minute one, that they would stop at nothing to crush this and remain in power. And so I just felt that all of us around the world had a stake in these guys' fight for freedom.
Well, let's talk about this. In the film, Wad, you say that you were in the fourth year of your economics degree when the revolution began, April 29th, 2012. and you film students in the science department saying, "We're overthrowing Assad. Raise your voices, raise your voices. We'll live in dignity or die."
Yeah.
This is a country drowning in corruption and injustice. So can you remind us, fourth year of your economics degree, what was it like for you growing up in Syria at that time? What is life like in Syria? What was it, I should say?
It was really normal life as any place around the world without any allowance for caring for anything out of just like study, work, and doing your basic stuff in your life as like just live in an apartment, have food, and that's it. The thing that we all felt before the revolution that no one of us have any belong or any feeling relationship with Syria as country. All our dream was, and Hamza has the same things, also a lot of other friends which I know before, we have also have that dream about we will finish our study and go to somewhere else out of Syria to study something outside and start our life out. The fact that the revolution started and we felt that we could really be the place in the place that we wanted to build in our own hands, in our voices, as we want to be. And just felt that, you know, instead of just going to somewhere else and start our life there, we can really make that life happen in Syria, in our, like, the government that we want to dream with, without corruption, with a lot of justice, with dignity. And this is what it felt at the beginning, because we were all, like, just, as Ed also mentioned, mixed of middle class and different things. We had many people from different cities around from Syria. So it was felt just, you know, something very important and something really will not just change our life, will change the life of Syria, maybe also the world itself. And that's what we hoped at that time.
Hamza, Wad said that people in Syria were planning to go to school and then leave. So why did people want to leave? What was life like under the Assad regime?
The main idea, the first, like, the main rule that we were, when we were before 2011, it's like, mind your own business. So we've never cared about the community. We've never cared about, like, even maybe the wider circle of the family, just like the close circle. And just like the dream was to, like, get to the university, graduate, and just move. Like, you've seen so many physicians, doctors working in France, in Germany, in the US, mm-hmm. in the UK. But they just, like, even, like, before the 2011, before the revolution, they just want to graduate and go. So many, like, engineers, what the dream of, like, in many sectors, just to go to the Gulf and work there and stay there. And after 2011, we felt like we have a stake in our country.
But can you give us a little bit of context? Life, what was life like before that? Why did you want to leave?
Because we know that it's still like our country or our city, but we don't have a stake in the future to this country. It belongs to Al-Assad and his family and his, like, wider circle. It's full of corruption. You can't have a future in this country. You can't have a big dream, because they will share your dreams with you. If you want to do anything, they will take it from you. Or, like, the best thing that will happen, you will be one of them and share even, like, your dreams and everything with them. It's just all belong. It's sad to say it, but it just was a big farm, and they were the farmers, and we were, like, just the different species that are just living there.
And at that point, what was the state of media, free speech?
Like, everything, as Hamza mentioned, it's Assad regime system. Even the media, even, like, there's no any place or where you can really write something or do something. Even we have that joke before, we've saying, like, even if you dream something against the regime, the next day you will see, like, the security forces coming to take you to prisons. So it's more, it's not just a security country. It's, like, really farther than that.
And, like, regarding the media, maybe 1 year ago, I remember that they, in Latakia, they were celebrating opening, like, a public water tape. So, like, you can, like, you know, just like praising the mighty of Al-Assad leader, and even like if he just opened a public water tap, that's like something to celebrate in the media.
And even we have also another joke since we were very, very young, we heard that from our parents. It's about like, don't trust the Syrian media, the regime one, the formal one, even if they will speak about the weather. So if they said it's like sunny, so of course
they
not. So yeah. So it's, everything was just like around Al-Assad family. Everything was just around the army and the security forces and everything around them and just them.
And the main thing that everyone knows that, but they were so afraid to do anything. Like you can't even trust your own family. Like, I can't tell the thoughts to my mother, because I will not know who will listen to this, or even she will report against me to get like a higher, not my mother, I'm sorry, mom. But even like for a brother, a sister, you can't share this like thoughts of anything. If you want to do like to get a scholarship to go like abroad, you know that there are always, it's not about grades or being a good student, just about being loyal to the family, and that's it. So you never dream about like, I will get a scholarship, I will do this. No, I will just mind my own business, graduate, and just leave.
I'm sorry, I'm still bringing old sentences. But also we have a very common like sentence which we heard also since we were speak about, like, the wall has ears. So this is something you can't share with anyone around you.
No, I think this is so important, just to get a sense of what life was like before the revolution, because we were talking just about the shallow media coverage and how the West tends to other people, you know, who are not from their own countries, for example. And we don't get that much context about what life is like in Syria. Yeah. That's why I think it's important to talk about this.
One of the really main stories, which when I was young, I've never realized how important is it. But now, after all these years, I'm really feel that this is something really important. When I was 15, I was the only student in the whole school, around like 500 students in that school, that I wasn't part of Al-Ba'ath party. And this is just because there was a problem between me and the teacher in misunderstanding about why this picture. And she was just shouting and forced me to sign this paper. And because just I was lucky because of my father was someone who really respect this space, that he should give us that. So he went to the teacher and told her, like, I will not let my daughter sign this. And you feel like, no, 500 students, no one have any chance to say no for something. It's just something automatically. When you are a child, and then when you will be like in the primary school, of course you will be like a member of Al-Ba'ath party. Hmm. This is automatically things. You don't have any choice to say yes or no for this.
I was a good member of Al-Ba'ath party. I'm not proud about
Syria,
it, but
everyone.
Like, I was part of the...
That's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, because like other parents will like if the school called them, tell them like your son hasn't signed the approval form or to join the Al-Ba'ath party, any other family would just came to the school, beat the child, and tell them in front of all the school and the teacher, you're not educated. We were like, you're like impolite,
yeah.
And you need to sign this, and then we will take you home and tell you like and how to become a good member of the community. And then they will go home and tell his son like I'm sorry, but you can't do this, they will arrest your father, so we need to do this. And everyone just know this in Syria.
Today we are joined by Wad Al-Khatib. She was a student in Aleppo when she began documenting the uprising in Syria, and she started out by sending her footage to Channel 4 in the UK for a series called Inside Aleppo. She got over 500 hours of footage, and Wad and Edward Watts turned that footage into an incredible documentary for Sama. Edward Watts is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker who's directed over 20 narrative and documentary films. He's director of For Sama. And Hamza Al-Khatib is a doctor and co-founder and former director of the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo. So thank you for explaining all of that. I think it's so important to talk about what life was like before the revolution. Let's talk about what you heard on the streets from the students who rose up and said, raise your voice, raise your voice. The revolution was peaceful. You have amazing footage in the film For Sama. Talk a little bit about what you heard from young people and students. What really sparked that revolution?
At the beginning, it was really something shocked everyone, like our parents, us as young people, even through friends. And as I remember, the first time I went to a protest and at the university, I was standing in the yard of the economics college, and we start hearing that voice, which is coming from not far place, but it's like not very clear. And one of my best friends, he was like standing next to me. He was saying, "Oh, this is a bro Assad protest." And then I was saying, "Like, no, it seems like it's something different." And he said, "No, of course. Like, what we will have here? Of course, it will be like bro Assad." And then we've seen how people were running out from the place where the voice coming from, and we've just run to that place and. I've literally remember how, like, there was around 20, 25 students who were standing in the, like, middle of the yard where the library, the university library was, and they were chanting, like, God, Syria, and only freedom. And, like, you know, I couldn't participate in that one. I was just, like, freezing in my place. You know, look at them, how they've, I couldn't believe that, you know. I'm hearing that, but I can't. There's something in my mind saying that this is wrong. You hear something wrong. This is couldn't be happened in Syria, and this feeling stayed with us for a long, long time. Even until now, when I'm hearing that voice, it's something, you know, like feel that it's like a miracle, and like a deaf and dumb person who's he've never heard his voice, and it's first time hearing that. You know, still having that great sense of this is really, like, this is not imagination thing. It's really happening. And during the whole years, like, with the time, what I think what make us still have a stake in what we went through and all the powerful and the strength that we have, it was coming from that days when you feel how people were really challenge everything just to go to the street and raise their voice and speak something they really believe in.
Mm. What would you add, Hamza?
The first maybe 2 weeks of the revolution when it started in Daraa, I didn't believe that. I, like, you know, I was like, how dare you stand against the regime and the government? Like, this is something. Not because it doesn't, like, worth it or there's no reason, there was a million reasons to just stand against the government, but I couldn't believe that the people will have the courage to do that. So frankly speaking, in the first week or two, I thought that some of propaganda or fake news that people are protesting in Daraa, because I couldn't think that they will have the courage to do it. And then, like, several of my friends at the university said, like, we're planning to do a protest in, it was a mosque close to the university. And one of the things also that I want to explain, that people were gathering in the mosques, and the protest started from the mosques and the university, because this was the only place that you are allowed to gather in without being suspicious. And because a lot of people were, like, criticizing the revolution, that it's all Islamic, it's from the mosque and everything. Because we have, like, a written law in Syria that if three people or more were gathering, that gives, like, all the permission for any security officer to go there and investigate why are you gathering. So it's, like, against gathering law. So that's why being in a mosque, it was just not very suspicious to be there, going to pray, and that's it. And you can tell, like, there is something wrong, because usually, like, the mosque is only, like, two lines of prayers, and one day it's like 20. So like, oh, you have faith now, people.
And some friends who were Christian, they were coming to the mosque. Wow. You can hear the story from many people about this.
Before we go to break, Edward, what really struck you about the footage that Wad got of specifically talking about the students who rose up?
Well, partly the bravery, always in Wad's footage. I think the first thing you think of is the bravery, because she captured a moment, a particular day when there were UN observers at the university, and you saw these, I mean, another thing obviously was the joy. I mean, I will never forget, we couldn't include all the images in the film, but we could have just rolled out these images of joy. It was like an extraordinary day. The students were bathed in sunlight, and as far as Wad had climbed up on some pedestal, and as far as the eye could see, there were just people so full of happiness. Like, I remember one part of the shot, which isn't even in the film, she just pans down and there's a guy giving like the double V sign with this huge grin on his face, and it's just this infectious joy. And then, of course, within a few minutes, the security forces start coming in. And it's an image that we do have in the film, and it really strikes me, because you just see the sort of familiar fascistic image, basically, of like soldiers marching into people, and you know what's coming, and Wad starts running. And so, yeah.
And the fact that this footage was from a UN car, like the officer who was sitting next to guy who filmed this footage was coming from one of our friends, like he was sitting next to the UN officer, and that's, they've seen all this footage as you've seen it in the film, because they were just in the car.
Yeah, that day like summed up the whole story in a way. It's like people full of joy fighting for freedom being met with violence, and the world just
watching.
So what did the UN do with that footage?
Well, they were there. I mean, you know best, probably. They were there observing, and they saw all sorts of horrendous things happening. And then
a screening at the UN on the 25th, and like there is a Q&A. So I think we will be asking them. So
yes.
Yeah, I have so many questions.
Wow. Well, I'd love to hear those questions. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are talking about the incredible new documentary For Sama, and you can find where it will screen at yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Wad Al-Khatib, who was a student in Aleppo when she began documenting the uprisings in Syria. And she started by sending her footage to Channel 4 in the UK. Over 500 hours of footage has been turned into this incredible documentary For Sama. We're also joined by Wad's husband, Hamza Al-Khatib, a doctor, co-founder and former director of the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo. And Edward Watts is director of For Sama. He's an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. And you can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking about an incredible new documentary called For Sama. Today's guest, Wad Al-Khatib, is a 26-year-old Syrian filmmaker who documents her life over 5 years during the brutal Assad regime as she falls in love, gets married, and gives birth to her daughter. I should also say, and this is very important, that Wad is also an Emmy Award-winning director of the film For Sama, along with Edward Watts. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We are also joined by Wad's husband, Hamza Al-Khatib, a doctor and co-founder and former director of the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo. At least 5.5 million people have fled Syria since 2011. 6.5 million have been displaced. Nearly 3 million are still living in hard-to-reach and besieged areas. Before the break, Hamza, I was saying, you know, what has the UN done if they were there during the revolution and saw the regime forces crackdown, and you said that you're going to have a screening with the UN and you have many questions. What are you planning to ask them?
Actually, there are so many questions. Before that, to give the audience the context, yeah. In the first 2 years of the revolution, I think we were maybe misleaded by the UN and even by the American government and other governments of the world, because most of the protest, there was like UN observers there. They call like the Arab observers. They were like sent by the UN to have a close look of the situation in Syria. And in several protests in Hama, the U.S. ambassador, his last name is Ford, I can't remember the first name, and
the French ambassador too.
And the French ambassador was there with the people. They seen it in their own eyes, how like there was around like 800,000 people in Hama protesting. And when we see like the American ambassador driving from Damascus to Hama to see the people, we say, oh, now our voices are heard. Now we have the support of the UN, of the American, like it's our real chance. We will do it like the same thing that happened in Tunisia. We will get their support if any brutal or violence happen, like it happened in Libya. So like it's really our moment. And then when they all like just went back, so, like and they start like to, there are so many like things that I would love to ask, like, because I know that the UN and the Security Council and all of other agencies and the governments know exactly what's going on in Syria. It's not like we're in like 18 something that nobody knows about anything. And it's just like, I know that they know everything, but still like with every time we had to explain and give all like so many answers about so many things. Like there was a chlorine gas attack in Aleppo. And then the first thing I've been asked, like, are you sure is it chlorine gas attack or something else? Like, I don't know. Come and investigate yourself. Is it like, oh, it was chlorine gas attack, so not sarin, so we can't say it's a chemical attack. It's just something like less. Why Al-Quds Hospital was the last hospital in Aleppo? Why do you think the Russian hadn't bombed it? Like, I have no idea. And it's just like, you know, very weird, just asking a rape victim, like, what were you wearing? And are you sure it was rape or just, like, sexual harassment?
Right. Well, and let's give people some context, because you're former director of the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo. And, Wad, I mean, the footage you got in that hospital, it was so hard to watch, especially the scene where a woman came in and had a cesarean, and you watched the doctors trying to revive her baby. I mean, it was just so hard to watch that.
It wasn't a doctor even. He was just a nurse.
It was a nurse.
We didn't have a pediatrician on that day. So even, you know, like, Hamza doesn't know what he should do at that moment. So everyone was just, you know, trying to do their best just to make that child survive.
And the child?
The child did survive. He's now with his mother in Ankara.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, Wad, like, connected with them a year ago. And they are very, very, very well.
So because you were in this position, in this hospital, you did so many media interviews trying to get the word out to the world. What really struck you about the questions the media asked you as time went on? I mean, you were talking about, was it chlorine gas? Why was your hospital bombed last? Those kinds of questions.
Yeah. It's just, I felt like, I don't know, because after 2014, all the media was obsessed by ISIS, the jihadists, the Islamic, the refugees crisis. And I felt like I need to, because I speak English, so, and a few doctors in Aleppo were like speaking English, and I was still believing in media and the power of like reaching the people of other countries, that they might really put pressure on their governments and their MPs and the Congress. But so I know that there are so many things that the Western audience or even the reporters don't know about Syria. So I feel like I need to explain everything. And there are like so many questions that were just weird, like those questions. Sometimes like, so like you are in East Aleppo, are you like treating ISIS? And like, like you don't know how to answer those questions. But
and sorry, easily for this, like ISIS was in Aleppo since 2013, maybe August or July, until the 1st of 2014. So even any like journalist who will ask this question, if you just Google, you know, when ISIS was in Aleppo, he will know that this is long time ago.
So, but I feel like, yeah, we need to explain that a lot. And I was explaining about, like, the chlorine gas attack and the difference of this. I need to study it because we didn't, like, study about chemical attacks in college. Mm. So I need to read several articles about, like, sarin and chlorine and what's the difference to explain this to the reporter in, like, hoping that our voice will be heard.
Mm. Edward, I mean, the footage, we talked about the footage from the revolution, the footage from the hospital, and just these families that decided to stay in Syria and how they hear bombs next door to them. Mm-hmm. We see so much blood on the ground of the hospital. There's so much chaos. There's brothers coming in, seeing their own brother die. Mm. And the mother's screaming. Yeah. I mean, can you talk about that footage?
Yeah, I mean, just unbelievable scenes of human suffering, really, and the true reality of conflict. I mean, and it's incredible testament to, well, to the hospital that Hamza founded, which became the only surviving hospital looking after people, and to what Wad did, well, how she managed to capture that footage. It was, you know, it was hours upon hours upon hours of just scenes of the most intense human suffering. And, you know, that was one of the things that we really discussed in the film, was that when we first sat together and I was going through it with her and she was talking to me about some of these stories that she'd encountered, you know, just this overwhelming sense that we both shared that we had to show people some of this horror. You know, people have to see this is what this war is about, and this is what the bombardment of civilian areas looks like, and it's the cost, literally, in the lives of children.
Wad, one of the other scenes that really got me, and I just was wondering, what is going through Wad's mind? What is she feeling right now? When you were filming bodies coming in, young kids crying for their siblings, the one mom who came in, she looked right in your camera, and she said, I think she said something like, "You're filming this? Are you filming? Why are they doing this to us?" I mean, basically, it was her message to the world. At first, I thought she was going to slap the camera and say, "How dare you do this?" But she wanted to send a message out to the world.
Actually, this is exactly what I felt when she asked me, like, "Are you filming?" And you've seen in the film how I turned the camera down a little bit because I wanted just to move or turn it off. And then she like shouted again, "Film me, film us, let the world see what's going on or why they did that to us." And, you know, like in that situation, you can think a lot about what's going on. The only thing was stuck in my mind all the time about I will be as one of them one day. It could be Sama, it could be Hamza, it could be anyone around me, and it could be me. So I just didn't think a lot about what does that mean, because I know that one day I will have the same pain exactly as I'm watching that. And the big responsibility of filming all these things, not just because one day it will be a film or it will be on the news, but also it's something, it will bring justice to Syria, like, very later. And even if I didn't survive, but I know that this footage one day, it will become with someone outside. And it will be a film, it will be a news, and it will be also a very clear evidence about what's going on in Syria. So when that woman shouted that, I've just felt that, you know, like, everything I'm doing now, it's worth. She's shouting to me, to said to me, like, "Yes, film. Yes, let that, like, let the world outside seeing that." And this is just something, you know, it's like break my heart, but same time it gives me a lot of strength about keep doing this, keep doing. People really worse, like, and they really appreciate what I was doing there.
Well, we have an email from Fran who says, "Thank you for your bravery and sharing so much of your lives with us." Fran says, "I saw For Sama last night at the Roxy, completely amazing and heartbreaking. Can you and Dr. Hamza address more of how women and children survived and fared during the long, horrifying siege of Aleppo? Fran writes, Miss Al-Khatib said in the film that she couldn't access diapers, food for the baby, and other requirements. When Miss Al-Khatib gets pregnant in the film with her second daughter, I wondered how and if women in Aleppo could access any kind of routine care for access to birth control, pregnancies, etc.
Yeah. You know, this is the, let's say, the lowest basic of people, how they can survive. We were very lucky in Aleppo because of the siege was just for 6 months. While, for example, in other place like Ghouta, it was for 5 years. And there's literally like cases of people who were like killed because of hunger. And we've seen that pictures through the years coming out from a place like Ma'adamiyat Sham. So what we expect in Aleppo when the siege started, the same scenario, that we don't know when the siege will be ended. So it's just long time of, we don't know when that will finish. So everyone who has some storage in his house, on like all the storage that the organization has in Aleppo, were divided between the people and the families who were there. So what do we have? We have like a lot of kind of like pasta and rice and the things that it just could be storage for a long time, while we don't have any kind of like fruit or vegetables. And this is what you feel like, yeah, I'm not hungry or I'm feeling okay, but I'm not very well, because you need that kind of fruit and vegetables to be have that power, you know, all the time. So what we've were like through these 6 months, because we knew that the siege will be for long time, and Aleppo was threatened to be besieged for more than 1.5 years before the siege. So everyone has some like storage, you know, personal storage. And for example, I was really counting how many hours I should wait until I should change for summer for the nappies. So I know like, okay, yeah, she needs to be changed now, but okay, I can wait or more like 3 hours for her. And you can think about everything else you when you should like count this, just everything you should, okay, I'm hungry now, but I can wait more 4 hours to eat. So even summer, like we've run out from the milk in many like times, and the only milk that we have, it was expired, and I was first myself to give this summer this kind of milk, and she stayed for 2 weeks sick because of this milk. She shouldn't drink that. And at that time, she was like 7 months. And I've feed her, eat like rice and kind of food, which I know she can't eat it, but this is the only way that she can survive. And as I told you, like, we were just lucky that the siege was just for 6 months, nothing more.
Yeah, regarding the the medication, it was available because usually we get the donation from the NGOs for like each 3 months or 6 months. So it was available because it wasn't like the siege wasn't for a long time. The main thing that we were worried about, that we don't know when the siege will finish. So even if we had like 10,000 of that like antibiotic, we don't know. Is it enough or not? Mm. And the main thing that was like for diapers, it was missing. But you have like other alternative, even yeah. like just
clothes. Like sometimes clothes people, sometimes, yeah, exactly. We've seen some of the people coming from the hospital, like when they've bought just, you know, like
like
all the clothes and like rub it with something like I don't know what. Something, yeah.
Yeah, like cloth.
Yeah.
We have about 5 or so minutes left. I want to ask you, you talked earlier, Hamza, about the Americans who were there and the UN, and you said, okay, now we're going to get the support we need. What does that mean to you? I mean, what did you want the West, the Americans, the UN to do at that point?
Like, at least to stop the Russian intervention, because in like the mid of 2013, the rebellions were controlling around 80 to 85% of Syria. The Assad was controlling in only 10 to 15%. Just Google it, and like just put the control area in Syria on 2013, and you were surprised about the green area that was taken by the rebellions, and then ISIS became. And most of ISIS leaders were in al-Assad prisons, in a famous prison called Sadnaya, and he let them out in 2013. And they start to control the area from the rebellions to start their, like, Islamic, the Khilafah. And
in 2013, like September, we've lost more than 30 persons in Aleppo City. They were all kidnapped by ISIS. And all these activists, they were wanted by the regime. So what the regime couldn't do, ISIS did,
ISIS
it.
Did it.
And it's just, you've seen, like, it's indirect way, but it's very direct way.
And after that, the Russian interferes. The Iranians were there. And, like, the Russian wasn't just supporting al-Assad with, like, the Americans used to the government aids from the American was just most of it canned food, but the Russian has supported Assad with everything, with soldiers on the ground, with aircrafts, and we didn't want that. We don't ask the Western governments to do that, but at least if like al-Assad got the Russian, the Iranians, Hezbollah, Iraqis militias, all of that support he got on the ground and on the sky. And if he didn't get that support, the Syria crisis would be finished, like, would be finished, like, years ago.
Wow, because we just got an email from John who says the civil war in Syria, which I know you don't like that term, and I'll ask you about that in a minute, is a lesson that bad guys can win. The Assad regime would surely have fallen if it weren't for the intervention of Russia and Iran.
Can
you
I
agree with that?
That Edward? Really chimes in, though, with the famous Churchill phrase, you know, the only thing that's required for the bad guys to win is for the good guys to do nothing. And I think there is, you know, there have been a number of moments, and these guys have talked about it, where, you know, we could have done so much more, you know, to pressure even economically the Russians for their intervention. I mean, as Hamza said, you know, the Russians did something by their own statistics, 72,000 airstrikes in the first year they were there, almost all of them directed against opposition forces. And, you know, these guys talk about Idlib, what's happening today. And I think what people have to understand is, you know, there are airstrikes happening like 10 or 20 a day. And yet the Assad regime, this has been going on for months now, you know, hundreds of civilians have been killed, medical facilities have been targeted, but the Assad regime still can't actually advance because they're fundamentally, they don't have support, you know, amongst the people. And this is the thing that we saw in this conflict, which was people facing a minority that had the monopoly of military force.
And can you talk about why you oppose the use of the term civil war to describe what's happening in Syria?
Like, civil war simply will be like between two equals armies or two equals like sides, let's say. Well, when a government like kill their own people with all these like armies and weapons and everything, and you've seen like the other side, what's being killed is children, women, and normal people and normal families, this is not a civil war. And a civil war, it will be also like between Syrian and Syrians, not between like Russia, Iranians, Hezbollah, and the Syrian regime, and then like the other side of the world.
Also, I feel like the terminology of civil war will make the people look for, like, get a step away. Like, it's Syrians killing each other. What we need to do about this? And same, like, I think it's same, not maybe not propaganda, but the same thing that also let people, a lot of people take a step back. Like, it's ISIS, we don't need to deal with it. It's Syrians killing each other, we don't need to do anything about this.
And can we talked about this briefly before the film, before the show started, Edward. What about these various factions in the United States, in the UK, who say that so much of this is propaganda, like the White Helmets are putting out propaganda? Can you talk about this, where this comes from?
It really blows my mind, you know. I find it very hard to understand how this has happened. I mean, essentially, I think they've been subjected to an overwhelming propaganda campaign by the Russians and the regime, and some, for whatever reason, they've bought into it. And I think that there are specifically individuals in England who they think they directly receive funds from the Russians, or, you know, it's cloaked in some sort of research grant or whatever, in order to produce, essentially, this propaganda, which is pure lies. There is absolute, this is like Goebbels level lies and misinformation. The White Helmets are an organization that only help people who are the victims of these terrible airstrikes and pull them out of the rubble and provide humanitarian care when their own government is trying to kill people. And, you know, I think one of the things that's so bizarre, which we were talking about just before, is the natural allies, people that you would expect to be standing with those who are fighting fascists, particularly on the left, they for some reason have got it into their heads that, you know, this is some like anti-imperialism thing. To support Assad or to support Russia is the right thing for people on the left to do, when, you know, our natural allies, or people on the left, are supposed to support people's desire for freedom, to stand against fascistic states. So it really is part of this confusion that has taken over our societies.
The last thing, just what I want really to not believe, that we are not living in a forest. This world now is became like a forest, and I don't want my daughter to raise up and in a place where, you know, I don't know what will happen next. I don't know if she will be in a place like safe anymore. Not just in Syria, even in the UK, even in the USA. All of us as a human being, we will pass away one day. We don't know this world, who we left it to.
Final thoughts, briefly?
The final thing, that this story is still happening. In the past 3 months, more than 26 health facilities were targeted and destroyed in Idlib. More than 800 children were killed, and it's still just happening. It's not too late to take action. It's not too late to support the people.
You're in touch with people who are still in Syria?
Yeah, Al-Quds Hospital is still functioning in Idlib.
And you're both living in the UK now?
Yeah.
Just 30 seconds. What changes would you like to see? I mean, what would you like to see happen?
The first thing, stop bombing like the civilians who are living in Idlib. Yesterday, a guy called Anas, he's 23 years old. He's one of the White Helmets filmmakers who are filming the attacks which happening. He was killed yesterday. Like, it's just unbelievable how it's still happening and still going on. You know, like Anas should have been here today, or like after a month here speaking with you about what's going on in the situation, and they've just killing all the evidence, all the, like, they want just to remove all the crimes that they've done.
So just like stop bombing hospitals, stop killing the civilians, and bring justice to the killed people.
Hamza Al-Khatib is a doctor and co-founder and former director of the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo. Wad Al-Khatib is an award-winning director. The film is called For Sama. She filmed over 500 hours of incredible footage, and I hope you can see this film. Edward Watts is also an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and director of For Sama. Wad, Hamza, and Edward, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for this amazing film. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.